Well, I've got to say, it's really exciting to see all these, well, not new faces to me, but like people that are new to most of the church. So welcome. I think I know almost all of you, but that's from other places, and we're grateful that you're here. You have lots of different places you can go and worship, and we really try to take it seriously when you come and worship with us. We get excited about it. So we've been in a series on mission, vision, values. Today we're going to talk about mission, but I want to ask you a few other things first. There are a bunch of words that I think people float around, and we don't know exactly what we mean. We misuse them often. For example, affect and effect. Which is which? That may be helpful to some, yes. I'm not... Effect is the result of, yeah, it's the noun. Affect is the verb. Yeah, Danielle's like, that's what I was going to say. All intensive purposes, that's not a phrase. That is mispronounced. It's all intents and purposes. Who knew? Chomping at the bit is not chomping like C-H-O-M-P. It's actually spelled champing at the bit. It comes from horses and them doing work and being anxious. One that I actually didn't know, fair to Midland is not a, it's not a saying. It's actually fair to middling. That makes less sense to me, but that's what the dictionaries and people who know about these things say. Compliment and compliment mean different things. Towards, anyways, those aren't words, unless you live in England, and none of you do. You don't need the S. It's just a waste of time and ink. Don't use the S. Away or toward and anyway. Nipped in the bud. Some of you are laughing. That's the right way. It's not nipped in the butt. That communicates something totally different. But we've all heard that saying. Nipped in the bud. Nip it in the bud. Elicit, illicit, and so on. So we've been talking about value and vision and mission. And I think that what happens is, we often just use those words kind of interchangeably. We use them somewhat irresponsibly because we think they all mean the same thing and they just don't. So my mission today is to make sure that we're not using mission, vision, values incorrectly or illicitly. That if we do, I nip that in the bud and that we can together affect the future that we are charging after. See what I did there? Anybody? Good. This is good, because that's all just fluff. So today we are talking about mission, but I want to walk through the things that we've talked about in the previous weeks just to kind of lay the groundwork again. Values. 2 weeks ago we said, what are the core values of the church? What really matters to us? If we're going to hang our hat on something, what is it? And I passed out a questionnaire and got like 30 of those back. And to remind us, values are the bedrock of what we hold as important. They're the beliefs and principles that govern how we make decisions, how we determine programs, how we explain internally and externally who we are and what we're about. Core values paint a picture of what we believe and what our principles are. They're the bedrock on which our vision and mission should be built. Vision is what we talked about last week. Remember, I read that section out of Amos. We were talking about it's not always popular, it's not always easy, but sometimes we have to have some transitions. The vision is the compelling, in Christian worlds, like churches, the God-revealed compelling picture of a preferred future which lures us or draws us optimistically to that future. It's the picture of a better day that we fix our eyes on and say, ooh, what if Manteca looked like that? What if Northgate functioned in this way? What if that was who we were? But it's all future, right? Mission supports our vision and communicates our lived out purposes and direction. It's what we do today so that we can achieve tomorrow's vision. Values kind of stands by itself. Nobody generally gets values confused with any of those other two things. It's mission and vision that we often are like, wait, which one is that? And I'm tempted to just say it actually doesn't matter that much. But it really does. We need to know what we're talking about when we use these words. So we're going to spend a little bit of time compartmentalizing. Vision is about your hopes and dreams. We talked a little bit last week about, you know, we shouldn't only have a vision for Northgate. not only a vision for the capital C church, but Miles should have a vision for his life. Where am I going? What is the better tomorrow? I should have some hopes and visions, whereas mission is kind of just the present day action, the stuff we do now to maybe chase down that vision. Two, what problems are we solving? When we talk about mission, it's how are we serving, right? There are these issues, how are we addressing them? Number three, who are we inspiring? This is why visions tend to have more like poetic language. They're bigger picture. They're fluffier. Mission is who do we serve? It's kind of nuts and bolts. Again, tomorrow focused versus today focused. What do we want to be versus what are we doing, like currently? Vision, when you see them, they have aspirational language. The root word of aspirational is aspire, things that you dream towards, you hope for, whereas mission is day-to-day functionality. What are you doing to accomplish this vision? Again, you'll notice that vision is kind of important here. If you don't have a vision, then the question is just, what are you doing? Which is less helpful, right? Vision has heart and seeing words, and mission has head and hand words. Mission is information, data, checklists, metrics, things you can measure, whereas vision is more, again, poetic and emotive and hopeful. Vision is compelling, mission is concise and concrete. I like this analogy. When you're driving a car, the low beams are super helpful if you need to see from me to Jeannie. But if you're on a backcountry road and you know it's like the time of year that deer are jumping across the street, you may want to throw your high beams on so you can see a little further down the road, right? Mission is low beams. You have great clarity about what's 10 feet in front of you. You don't have as much clarity about what's 50 feet or 100 yards in front of you. For that, you want high beams. Vision is strategic. It's the whole war, right? It's World War II versus mission being the Pacific Rim, right? When you look at mission, it's tactical. It's very specific. It's finite. It's the battle, winning that battle, whereas the vision is sort of the whole war. There are two... So I've been looking up a lot of vision statements and mission statements because I think these are helpful. These are both from secular organizations, but I think they're both awesome. The first is from TED. Does anybody listen to TED Talks? I know a few of you do. Yeah, lots of you. Good. If you don't, do that. TED, their mission is to spread ideas. It's concise. It's succinct. We don't have any questions about what that means, right? Spread ideas. Their vision... They say, we believe passionately in the power of ideas to change attitudes, lives, and ultimately the world. Big. Hopeful. Aspirational. They have a dream of what they want to accomplish just by sharing information, by spreading ideas. Airbnb. Has anybody done an Airbnb? Man, some of them are really awesome. Some of them are really terrifying. Airbnb. Some of you are like, what is that? Well, let me just tell you what they say. Their mission is belong anywhere. We get that. It's nice. The idea of belonging is something that always evokes some emotion in us. Belong anywhere. But their vision, I feel like, is like the vision of a church. Tapping into the universal human yearning to belong. The desire to feel welcomed, respected, and appreciated for who you are, no matter where you might be. Man, if the church... adopted that vision, that would be dynamite. You see how one is big. It's hopeful. It's optimistic. It yearns. The other is stuff that you can just check off. So what I want to do for the rest of our time is look at values, vision, and mission by focusing on one story from Scripture. I'm not going to have the Scriptures up there because I'm jumping around. You're welcome to find it in your own Bible, but again, I'm jumping around, so we'll see how that goes. But what I want us to be looking for is what parts of the story of Joseph illustrate how his values are at play, what parts of Joseph's story illustrate his vision for his life, and what parts of Joseph's story illustrate him just being on mission. So we're going to read through, I'm not going to just read through 13 chapters of Genesis because you would all leave in the middle. So I'm going to pick and choose to kind of try to highlight some elements. But let me tell you this story first because I think this is just fun. My wife and I started dating in 2002. Yikes. We started dating a long time ago. 2000, whatever she said, two. I was not yet a believer, really. And I remember one of the very first dates we went on that was like a proper date, because we were in college, just graduating, is I took her to this really nice restaurant on the coast of Lake Erie, and we had this delicious food. I remember we had calamari, and it had the little legs on it, and I hadn't seen it that way before. And I'm like, oh, shoot, do you eat those ones? Are those decorative? So we like watched around, and people were like, oh, they're chowing. We're like, oh, okay, we eat the legs. Great. And then the other big payoff to this date, because I was really trying to woo this woman because, as I've said before, she is a stone-cold fox, and I liked her. So what I did is we were going to go see Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Has anybody listened to or seen Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat? One person. Awesome. It's about the story that we're reading today. The silly part of the story is Leanne and I drove up and down Mayfield Road looking for the Jewish Community Center for 2.5 hours because that's where this thing was. We never did find the place. I spent what at that point was all this money on these great tickets to woo this Christ-loving person by telling this Christ-loving story, and we just wasted the money. We never did get to see it. But I'll just tell you the story today. I was thinking about singing it to you, but again, I wanted to keep everybody here. So I'm going to start in Genesis 37. Most of you probably know this story, but I'm going to assume some things that maybe some of you don't know. Joseph was the son of Jacob. Remember Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Isaac, who was Jacob's father, had a brother, Ishmael. This is kind of the early part of the family tree. Verse 37 says this: Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. These are the family records of Jacob. At 17 years of age, Joseph tended sheep with his brothers. The young man was working with his sons of Bilhah and Zilpha, his father's wives, and he brought a bad report about their work to his father. This is the first piece of Joseph's values that we see. You may say, oh, he's tattling on his older brothers. No, his other brothers are messing around on the job. They're clowning around, and Joseph comes back and is like, Dad, they're just not doing their work. Joseph has a really rigorous work ethic, which we'll continue to see. Verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than his other sons because Joseph was a son born to him in his old age. And he made a robe of many colors for him. When his brothers saw that their father had loved him more than all the rest of his brothers, they hated him and couldn't bring themselves to speak peaceably to him. Verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, listen to this dream I had. There we were, binding sheaves of grain in the field. Suddenly, my sheaf stood up, and your sheaves gathered and bowed down to my sheaf. Are you really going to say that you're going to reign over us? His brothers asked. Are you really going to rule us? So they hated him even more. As it turns out, older brothers don't like to hear that you are going to be their boss someday. Doesn't play well. Verse 9. Then he had another dream and told this to his brothers as well. And it ends up being essentially the same kind of a thing. There are 12 that are going to be bowing down to me. And even his father Jacob gets upset at this. But this is the vision that Joseph has at 17 years old. Now he would say that God has given him this vision. He's given him this picture of a preferred future. And that is going to be the thing that we see focusing Joseph throughout the rest of the scriptures today. Verses 5 to 11 is what we just read. The rest of the relevant plot is the brothers had just kind of had it up to here. They were done hanging out with Joseph and his sort of pretension. So they came up with a couple schemes to get rid of him. The first one was, well, let's just kill him And then his little brother said, or his older brother said, well, let's not necessarily do that. There's probably some middle ground between killing him and just not having to deal with him anymore. So they decide to throw him into a pit and just leave him for dead, which isn't really any kinder. And then while the brothers are sitting up having their celebratory lunch because they've gotten rid of this annoying brother of theirs, they see some Ishmaelites, the descendants of Ishmael, walking by. And so they say, why don't we sell our brother, make a little cash? He doesn't have to die. Everybody wins, right? So they sell their brother into slavery. How kind. Then they realize, oh, well, Dad's going to wonder where he went. So they take this coat that he gave Joseph, that Jacob gave Joseph, that Joseph loved, and they dipped it in the blood of a goat. And they told his father, hey, Joseph was attacked by a wild beast. He gone. Sorry, it's over. And of course, Jacob is sobbing. He's like, oh, my favorite son, it's terrible. That's the rest of chapter 37. 38, we don't really care about. 39. 38 talks about Judah and his wife. Not relevant to where we're going today. Chapter 39, Joseph is sold to the Ishmaelites. And once he's sold to the Ishmaelites, they sell him to this man, Potiphar. Have you guys heard of Potiphar? Some of you, yes. So Potiphar is, he's kind of a steward. He's got some authority himself. And he really loves Joseph's work ethic. He loves how he works, how he thinks, how he focuses. He ends up putting Joseph in charge of all of his affairs. Potiphar is like the head master of his servants. All authority that Potiphar has, he gives to Joseph. Now, Joseph is a good dude. Again, we see his values start to come out. Hard work, stays focused, knows that he's supposed to be a leader. He's also a handsome fella. And his Potiphar's wife kind of sees Joseph's a handsome fella. So she, for a long period of time, is trying to seduce Joseph. Hey, you have full authority. Everything that he has is yours. And Joseph's like, no, I don't think he meant that, right? No, that's not going to happen. So he keeps resisting, and eventually she like rips his coat off. And he just flees. He runs away, and then she frames him. She makes up the story about how Joseph tried to seduce her. Potiphar's not very happy. Again, Joseph is enslaved. Sends him out, put in prison. And here we are, like the third time that Joseph has been abandoned by everybody. He's living in a jail cell. No real options. Just kind of a dismal situation. The jailer there notices Joseph, hardworking, man of conviction, handsome, people respect him, he has authority. So this jailer puts him in charge of other people. You see this pattern, right? Joseph's initial vision was, I'm going to be ruling over specifically my brothers, but he's not quite there yet. He's just ruling over everybody who seems to come in contact with him. He's given great authority. While he's in prison, there are two folks, a cupbearer and a baker. Now, Joseph is a dream interpreter, as we saw from his own dreams of the 12 sheaves of corn and so on. At this point, one of the cupbearers says to Joseph, hey, I've had this dream. What do you make of it? Let's see if we need to read that or not. Joseph basically interprets the cupbearer's dream as great news. It's that, hey, cupbearer, you fell into disgrace with Pharaoh, but that's all going to be changed here. In just a few days, you're going to go back and you're going to be at the Pharaoh's right hand. You're going to be restored back to your original glory. Obviously, the cupbearer is very excited about this because his life has gone from greatness to prison back to greatness. So then the baker, who's this other guy in prison, is like, yeah, tell me. Do my dream. And it doesn't turn out so well for the baker. But Joseph still delivers the truth. He interprets the dream appropriately and tells the baker, yeah, you're going to be hanged in 3 days. Sorry. after this, Pharaoh hears about Joseph. Pharaoh has a dream of his own, which I will read to you. At the end of two, this is chapter 41. At the end of 2 years, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing beside the Nile when seven healthy-looking, well-fed cows came up from the Nile and began to graze among the reeds. After them, seven other cows, sickly and thin, came up from the Nile and stood beside the cows along the bank of the Nile. The sickly, thin cows ate the healthy, well-fed cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. When he fell back to sleep, he had a second dream. Seven heads of grain, plump and good, came out of one stalk. After them, seven heads of grain, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up. And the thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven plump ones, and Pharaoh woke up again, being grateful it was only a dream. So as that next day started, he went to all of the interpreters he could find. Who are the dream interpreters? Who are the magicians? Who are the sorcerers? What does this dream mean? Tell me the truth. Nobody can interpret it. Cupbearer had just conveniently been placed back in power on the right hand of Pharaoh. And the cupbearer says, oh, dude, I know this guy, Joseph, who, if we had read the previous section in verse 14 of chapter 40, Joseph says to the cupbearer, hey, if I'm going to interpret this dream for you, I need you to remember me, right? Today, that's called LinkedIn, right? It's just networking. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. And so the cupbearer says, oh, yeah, dude, I know this guy who's in prison who interprets dreams. And so Pharaoh says, well, bring him up. Verse 14 of 41. Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and they quickly brought him from the dungeon. He shaved, changed his clothes, and went to Pharaoh. Again, values. Joseph doesn't just roll out of prison in his, like, nasty burlap sack and, like, stained face. He says, I'm going to go meet Pharaoh. There's opportunity here. His values of hard work and representing himself well come through. And he's also on mission, right? This is all part of, this is how you get places. He knows what he wants to do and what he's about. Verse 15. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream and no one can interpret it, but I have heard that you can interpret dreams. Joseph says, I am not able to. It's God who will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So Pharaoh tells Joseph his dream, and Joseph begins to interpret it. And verse 25 is the beginning of his interpretation. Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams mean that mean the same thing. The two dreams mean the same thing. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of wheat are 7 years. The sickly ones of the cows and the wheat are a time of famine. In verse 28, it's just as I told Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt. After them, 7 years of famine will take its place, and the abundance in the land of Egypt will be forgotten. Verse 33, so Pharaoh says, oh my. He says, look for the discerning wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appoint overseers over the land and take the fifth of the harvest of the lands for himself. He starts asking, where am I going to find a guy who can interpret these things? Where am I going to find a person who's got this level of discernment, this level of wisdom? And Joseph's just standing there like, hello, here I am. In verse 38, verse 37, Pharaoh says, hey, you should be my guy. You have the wisdom, you have the work ethic, you have the values, you've had this vision. You should be the one that administers my kingdom. And Joseph, of course, is like, well, yeah, okay. So he signs on, and the rest of chapter 41, is how his mission expands. The day-to-day, he starts saying, hey, this portion of every year's crop is going to be put in storage so that at the end of 7 years, we're not sitting there with an empty bag of food and we don't have anything to do. He's preparing. He has the vision of preparedness. He's seen the dreams. He's interpreted them, and he says, this has to happen. But it's not just pie-in-the-sky, distant future vision. He also has the discernment and the wisdom to say, These are the steps we need to take to get there. So Joseph organizes it all. He goes on in verse 42, his brothers who he had left, or who had left him, are outside of Egypt's control and they don't have any food. And so they get desperate and they go to Egypt. They don't recognize Joseph is the man that they're talking to. And the brothers look at him and say, hey, can we get some food? Our sheep don't have anything to eat. We're running out of food. We have nothing. Joseph thinks they're spies and deciphers a plan that they can prove to themselves or to him that they're not spies, which involves one of them staying behind, the other 10 going back and getting their brother and eventually his father. If your siblings had left you in a pit, talked about killing you, sold you into slavery, I don't know. I'm a pretty forgiving guy, and it is my brother, I guess, but I would be a little fired up. But Joseph just plays it cool, man. They still don't know who he is. They go all the way back to Canaan, and they come back, and they go all the way back to Canaan, and they come back. Joseph comes up with another plan to test their values. Are my brothers good people? He frames one of them for having stolen one of his cups. He tests them. And Judah, the oldest of the brothers, passes the test with flying colors. And at the end of all this, Joseph looks at his brothers in a courtyard like this, right? He's essentially a king. He's over all the affairs of Egypt. And he tells all of his attendants, leave the room. And everybody leaves except for Joseph's family, who had abandoned him, and Joseph. And he looks at them, and he tells them who he is. And he's weeping. And his family starts weeping. This is the culmination of the vision that Joseph had had when he was 17 years old, the same vision that made his brothers throw him in a pit. So it's not necessarily that the vision that Joseph had was all that compelling, to his brothers at least, but it's a vision that was released or revealed by God. It's one that God orchestrated. You see in several times in this section, in chapter 45, verses 7 to 10, just after Joseph reveals his identity to his brothers, he says this: God sent me ahead of you to establish you as a remnant within the land and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Therefore, it was not you who sent me here by throwing me in a pit and making me a slave and putting me in prison, but it was God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, ruler over all of Egypt. Return quickly to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph has said. God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me without delay. So Joseph is keen on pointing out the fact that he's not just the product of circumstances. All of this has been part of God's vision for Joseph's life, and he recognizes it. Now again, just having a vision doesn't really get us anywhere. If you only have a vision and you don't have values to hang your hat on, doesn't really get you anywhere. If you have a vision and you have values, but you don't know what steps to take to get there, if you don't have the missionality, the day-to-day, doesn't really get us anywhere. So you see, in all of these things, these are all the illustrations of in this text, of Joseph relying on his sort of core values. Dad, the boys are playing around when they shouldn't be. Refusing Potiphar's wife's advances. Deferring to God. Not reacting poorly when his brothers are up. All of this is evidence of his core values. You see how this is at the center of who Joseph is. So if you just know that this person does this, you can say, that's the kind of guy I want to be around. If you just knew Joseph's core values, you would say, I think I have an understanding of who he is. Vision, much simpler because it's in the future. We don't know how it's revealed. But these are elements in the story where you see his vision playing a role, focusing his effort, focusing his heart, focusing his attention, determining his behavior. These are all elements where you see him fighting to stay on mission, being aware of what the day-to-day looks like so that you can accomplish this thing that God has revealed to you in the future. So how does this matter to us at all? We are a church who is hopefully prayerfully saying to Jesus, what are we about? What is your vision for Northgate? What is your vision for this community? Whether that's Lathrop to Louise, Union to Maine, or Manteca. But Jesus, please, what are we about? Because we are a church. As you look around right now, notice those of you who are here all the time, there are other people poking around with a little bit of interest. We want to be able to say to these visitors, to ourselves, this is what we're about. We are going to change this. Jesus told me, we want to be able to say this. This isn't prophecy. We want to be able to say, Jesus told me and us, our leadership, that this is what we're going to do. This is what we're about. That's the new future. It's built on these values that we have, and this is how we connect it. Because the church globally is changing. So this is exciting. We look at this story because this is how Christ organizes our lives when we catch a glimpse of a vision that he has for us and we start to pursue it. Even in times of tumultuousness, even in tumultuous times, God's hand is at work. If we can be hypnotized, mesmerized, seduced by the vision that he gives us, these people, for a different tomorrow, then as we run into conflict, it's cool. As we start to say, oh man, I don't know what to do in that case. That's cool. We will cross those bridges when we get there. But if we don't have something that we're looking at, and we don't know what our bedrock is, we're just treading water. And so as I've said 50 times now, Northgate is changing. I don't know if it's a radical change or not, but the change that will happen is that we will at least know why we're getting together and what we're going to accomplish and what God has put us here to do. That's the future that we get to be exploring now. And so if you are a visitor, man, this is a fun time to come because we're just writing all kinds of things now. We are rewriting the future of this church, and I believe we're rewriting the future of this part of Manteca. And I want to personally invite you to be a part of that. I don't know exactly what the process is going to be, but if change and transformation and renovation and rejuvenation, if that's exciting to you, man, that's what we're living into right now. And so I want to look at all 80 eyes in the room and say, please get with me. If you want to have a significant part in this, I don't want us to just rely on the pastor and the executive team to do this. Nope. It's your church. We all need to have a say. We all get to have a say. We may not do the thing that you want us to do. You may think we should be about knitting hats for kitties. We're not. But I would love to hear that. Because this is the body that you live in. The hand communicates to the liver, and the liver communicates to the heart. We need to have open communication as we look at 2018 and the future. Because, folks, the church, man, we're going to do some cool things. I don't know what they are yet. I want you to help teach me. I want you to help hear from Jesus what those cool things are. So if you're interested in being a part of that, or if you're just like, I don't understand, please come talk to me because I want to make sure that we put the people that God has ordained to be a part of this revisioning in place. I don't want us to default to the people who are the usual suspects. I want to hear from the people who God is speaking to about our future for Northgate and Manteca. I'm going to pray and we're going to finish our time of worship. Heavenly Father, you tell us so many stories through your scriptures, some that we have heard and forgotten, some that we've never heard. But Lord, in all the lives of the people cataloged in your holy book, in the scriptures, you teach us something. How to behave, how not to behave. How to pray, how not to pray. How to love, how to serve, how to dream, or how not to. And so, Father, I pray that the witness that is bared out in Joseph's life would be made apparent in this room today. His commitment to you and your vision, his willingness to step out, to endure hardship, to accomplish the things that you have promised him. Lord, I pray that Joseph's life would be a model for us. As we start to look at 2018 and 19 and 20 and 21, as we start to look at just into the future, Father, I pray that you would be gentle with us as you encourage us into that future. That you'd speak loudly, that you'd speak boldly and clearly, but that you would also be patient with us as we continue to explore change, that you would just gently push us forward with the reliance that comes only from knowing that the things that we're chasing after have been revealed from your Spirit directly into our hearts. And that with that knowledge and that faith, Father, you would encourage us and empower us to be bold and brave and to courageously chase down the new picture of our new future. And we know, Father, that it's only through the power of your Son's name that we can do these things and through the partnership and leadership of the Holy Spirit. So, Father, we pray for more of those. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen.